Let's go spirit hunting. I'm Susie Carrick, Chief Taster and Tale Spinner from NZ Spirit Guide, and you're listening to Tales from the Top Shelf, where we meet the makers, explore the distilleries, and uncover the people, passions, and the stories behind New Zealand's world-class spirits. Kia ora and welcome to Tales from the Top Shelf, the show where we uncover the stories behind New Zealand distilleries, the people who create them, and the spirits that fill our glasses. I'm Susie Carrick from the NZ Spirit Guide, and this week we're joined by Matt Bridge, the distiller behind two very different but equally fascinating brands, Lunatic and Lover Rum and Sea Lovers Gin. Based on Auckland's North Shore, Matt has taken inspiration from a life spent sailing, a love of rum, and a deep connection to the ocean to create spirits that have developed a loyal following both here and overseas. Matt, welcome to Tales from the Top Shelf.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Great, thank you. Now, Matt, before there was a distillery, there were years spent sailing around the Caribbean. Tell us about that chapter of your life and how a sailor developed such a fascination with rum. And how did you end up on the shores of New Zealand?
Yeah, there was a lot to unpack there. So it wasn't not just solely the Caribbean. I've been lucky enough to be, a professional sailor of one sort or another for a long time. And I still do a lot of sailing. Spent a lot of time in the Mediterranean as well as the Caribbean and across the Pacific as well. So that was my first career, if you like. Right from a very young age, I realized that I didn't have to go into an office. I could go out and sail boats for a living. It seemed like a much better idea. honestly, there's been times if I could tell you what I did day to day or from week to week, you'd wonder why I'd want to go and start a distillery, because it was a pretty nice lifestyle for a long period of time. And I'm still lucky enough to dip into it. I've just, for example, just come back from a trip to a sailing regatta in Greece. And so I'd still love to be part of that scene. And it's still a big part of my life. I did spend a couple of years there living in the Caribbean, and that's where I sort of first discovered rum, although, as I said before a few times, at that age it was probably more about quantity than quality. You could get a bottle of I think it was Mount Gay rum for about $4 or $5 US, and slab of coke to go with it was about 13 or 14, so you paid more for the coke than you did for the rum.
Yes.
Anyway, that was my introduction to rum, and I was lucky enough to try some really nice Caribbean rums, and it sort of opened my eyes to what was available. And it's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? A yachty who likes rum.
Yeah, exactly. And then how did you end up on the shores of New Zealand?
That was good. I wanted to, at the time I was sort of living and working on the boats full time. And I wanted to step ashore, because I wanted to have a bit of life outside of a boat. It gets, it can take over your life, miss all the family events and it was away. So, and New Zealand seemed like a really good place. That I've been there once or twice before, had, connections over here. And it was, had a strong yachting scene as well. So I was able to carry on in the same industry I was in, but be shore based. So it seemed like a good place. And I thought I might like to live here, and so that's pretty much how it happened.
And here you are.
Yeah, 20 odd years later, I think 22 years I've been here now.
Right, okay. Now, I understand that Lunatic and Lovers started over a conversation about what to do next. How did the idea of a distillery first come about, and was there a moment when the idea stopped being the dream and became something that you wanted to pursue?
So you're right. I mean, like all good ideas, it was born over a bottle of rum one evening. And I think, I was talking with my brother-in-law at the time, and he had his own business, and I was working with somebody else. And I kind of knew that I wanted to start my own business in some shape or form. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't really thought about this thing, but I was kind of aware that there was this. It was right at the start of when sort of craft distilling was becoming, propping up on people's radar. And I remember distinctly remember sat there looking at this bottle of rum in the middle of the table. It was late in the evening, and it's all, why is nobody making rum here? You know, why is there no real sort of New Zealand rum? And there were very few Australian rums other than Bundaberg at the time. It's like, well, you know, surely this is a gap in the market. There are whiskies and there are gins, and there was 42 below vodka. And it's like, well, you know, is rum going to be the next thing? And so, yeah, we should start our own rum distillery. Yeah, brilliant. Great. But it was literally the next morning I sort of woke up and said, well, actually, how do you make rum? And that was the genesis of it. And I decided, I just went online and did some research and found a few books and ordered them off Amazon. And of course, being in New Zealand where home distilling is legal, there's a strong home distillers community.
Yeah.
And so I realized that you could then, you know, go and buy a little 10-liter still and start messing around and figuring it out that way. But it was, I'm not sure there was any one particular moment, because even that early stage, I was learning. It wasn't like I was a home distiller who was making lots of different stuff and thought, oh, I can turn this into a business. It was always mm-hmm. a view to, I'm going to start a rum distillery. So all yeah. my experiments, I wasn't making gin back then, and I wasn't doing this, that, and the other. I was literally figuring out how to make a rum right from the get-go. So it was quite focused in that point. And then I guess it became real when I started to accumulate sort of larger scale equipment and tanks and bits and bobs like that. And suddenly I had a container in the backyard with, you know, 1,000-liter copper pot still. I was like, oh, this has got a bit out of hand.
Yeah, that's a bit more than a hobby. Yeah. Okay, now Lunatic and Lover is such a distinctive and memorable name.
Yeah.
How did you come up with it, and what made you decide it was the perfect fit for the brand?
Yeah, so I mean, rum, looking at all the other rum brands that are around, particularly at that time, they were pretty unimaginative, very staid sort of marketing. The bottles were pretty average, lots of pirates, lots of, you know, sailing boats and all this kind of stuff on the labels, and quite cliched. And so I was keen to try and do something a little bit different in that department, as well as the rum itself. I wanted the brand to stand out. So the name itself is came from a Shakespeare quote. So from Midsummer Night's Dream, the line is, the lunatic, the lover, and the poet are of an imagination all compact. And it's Shakespeare talking about people who look at the world slightly differently, and how eventually mm-hmm. goes on to say that you shouldn't discount their viewpoint, even though they might seem slightly unhinged. And that sort of fitted nicely with what we were trying to do. This whole concept of botanical rum was quite different. Nobody was really doing it at that time. And I thought it was a really rich territory. You could expand on it in terms of the marketing and what the bottle might look like. It just mm-hmm. just seemed like a lot of fun, and as fun as it was making the rum, coming up with the brand was a big part of that creative process that we really enjoyed.
Yeah, I mean the bottles are stunning with the shape and the color, and they definitely do stand out. Now, you touched on the botanical rum. You became known as New Zealand's first botanical rum.
Yeah.
For listeners who haven't tried one, what exactly is a botanical rum, and what made you think that rum could be pushed beyond the traditional expectations?
Yeah, I mean, initially it started out was obviously if we're going to make a rum, you can do white rums and you could do spiced rums, and, you know, I guess the traditional rum would need to sit in barrels. So it's like you kind of need a product that you need to get out there a bit earlier. And that was where the original, you know, I started looking at this. There is no one definition of what a botanical rum actually is. So it's not like an internationally defined term. And there are some brands that make it pretty much just a fancy term for a spiced rum, and there's very little difference. You know, they take a rum, they might add some flavorings to it, and they sweeten it exactly the same with a spiced rum, but because they want to sort of differentiate themselves, they just happen to call it botanical. We do things quite differently. For a start, we use proper plant material, actual botanicals. It's not just essences or flavorings that we add after. The other big thing that we do is that it's part of the distillation process. We don't add anything back in afterwards. We're not sweetening, we're not adding vanilla or coloring afterwards. Mm-hmm. Everything is done during the distillation process. So it's effectively a gin technique that we're using to, yeah. to put those flavors into the rum. I mean, rum obviously takes flavors very well, otherwise the, you know, wouldn't spiced rum wouldn't be as popular as it is. I just wanted to do that in a different way. So yeah, no real definition of what botanical is. If I was to be asked what I'd like it to be, it would be, I don't really care if it's done during distillation or afterwards, mm-hmm. just that it uses actual plant material and actual botanicals, not just essences. And you know, I'd like to say that it's unsweetened as well. That would be my wish.
Absolutely. And what are some of those botanicals that you do use in your rums?
Yeah, well, we use about 12 different botanicals. They are a mix of New Zealand natives and some more exotic ones as well. Mm-hmm. So we've got, from the New Zealand natives, we've got Horopito in there. There's also one called Marihau, which I've got a forage for.
wow.
Yeah, so, and they use that in fairly small amounts. It's very aromatic, but it's quite bittering on the palate, so you've got to be a little bit judicious with that. And then there's cardamom. We've got cacao nibs from the Solomon Islands in there. There's orange peel. There's a little bit of coffee in there, nutmeg, allspice. Yeah, so there's a whole raft of stuff in there.
Yeah.
The idea is that it's not really about one botanical in particular. Is that they create a symphony of flavors and sort of come together as a whole.
Absolutely, but very much like you do with gin.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah. Balance is key.
Yep, absolutely. Now, Imagination Distilled has become a key part of Lunatic and Lover's identity. What does that philosophy mean to you, and how does it influence the way you create new spirits?
Yeah, I mean, I like to think differently, and I don't like to just follow the pack, I think. You know, the whole concept of botanical rums I mentioned before, nobody was really doing it. It's not just in New Zealand, throughout the world. There was maybe one or two others that were using the term when we launched. There's a few more now. So it was this willingness to try different things. And that sort of translates through into the other products we do, even though they might seem on the face of it a lot more traditional, like a normal unflavored rum or a white rum, for example, couldn't get much more basic than that. But the approach we've used with that is, rather than just doing what everybody else is doing, we're doing things like we're trying really unusual yeasts, trying techniques from different disciplines, looking at brewing, looking at winemaking, what are they doing? So although I've got 40-odd casks of what you would term traditional rum aging in the warehouse, very few of them are actually straightforward. They're all done with complicated fermentations, say different yeasts, experiment, non-standard Saccharomyces yeasts, to try and develop these flavor profiles and do things a little bit differently. So yeah, just an approach to the way we go about it, you know.
Absolutely. Now, beyond the flagship rums you initially started with, you've developed a range of other rums with different flavor profiles. Your overproof is a particular favorite of mine.
That's my baby as well.
That bottle didn't last long. Out of all your creations, which one has challenged you the most, and which one surprised you with how people responded to it?
Funnily enough, it's the two white rums. It's the fundamental and the exponential. You've mentioned the exponential is the overproof. Mm-hmm. Now, that's kind of a bit of a passion project. There's not a huge market for overproof unaged rum. And for a start, particularly in New Zealand, people look at white rums and they think, oh, it's like a Bacardi or something, you know, which is quite very light, doesn't really have a lot to say for itself. Whereas, of course, in other parts of the world, that's not the case at all. You know, you go to the French Caribbean where they're making it with sugarcane, or Jamaica, where they have Ray and Nephew's really punchy, flavorful, you know, not shy retiring wallflowers, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And a big part of the drinking culture there. So I wanted to do something similar. And it's always a great surprise to me when I give somebody some of the exponential and they're trying it neat. It's 60%. So it's like, oh God, you know, they're sometimes a bit trepidatious of it. But then to see their reaction to it and realize that, you know, that these rums can be really delicious and complex, even though they're completely unaged. That's pretty cool. Probably the most challenging was the step before that, and that was the fundamental, which is on the surface of it, it should be the most straightforward rum to make. It's just a unaged rum in a pot still process. But that's actually, to get something that's good to drink straight off the still is actually really, really difficult. That was certainly the most challenging, because you've got to have good molasses to start with. Your fermentation has got to be on point, because if you develop any off flavors in the ferment, because you're using a pot still, you can't really clean it up that much. You know, if you had a foreign still, you can just crank it up a little bit and purify a little bit more. Yes, you're going to lose some flavor, but it'll get rid of some of those sulfuric off notes. But with a pot still, you don't have as much option there. So you've got to really, really control your fermentation, temperature, yeast, you know, how much your pitch rates, all this kind of stuff. It's got to be spot on to develop as little of those off notes as you possibly can. Then the distillation, you got to make sure your cuts are on point, and you can't do anything after distillation other than proofing it down. You know, you can't rely on a barrel to hide it. So in terms of challenging, getting a straight unaged white rum that's good to drink straight off the still is ostensibly the simplest but also the most challenging.
Wow. Okay, there you go. Right. And then after the rums, then came along Sea Lovers Gin, a completely different brand and personality. What sparked the idea to move from rum into gin, and why did the ocean become its inspiration?
Yeah, that's a good question. I didn't want to be a gin distiller. I joke this with everybody. I mean, I do actually quite enjoy drinking gin, so, you know, I'm all right with it. But initially, I thought there's plenty of other people doing this. You know, I'll leave that to them. I'm a rum man. And then one day, I met a colleague of mine, Jill Mulvaney, who imports a lot of the copper Alembic Labs, and she's done a lot of gin education courses.
And consultant.
And we were at an event, and she said, "Oh, Matt, you're a sailor. Have a smell of this. Try this gin. I've just tried this recipe. You'll like it." And she gave me a little sample of it, and immediately I was blown away by how much it took me to the seaside. You know, literally getting walking on the beach. You know.
Yeah.
I thought, wow, that's pretty amazing. I've never actually experienced that with a gin before, where it took you to a specific place straight away.
Yeah,
I didn't think much of it. And then at the same time, through my other work, I worked for a sailmaking company called Doyle's, and still do. And they were doing a lot of work with Live Ocean. I don't know whether you've
heard of it.
The Ocean Conservation Charity.
Yeah.
And I just sat there and I was thinking about this gin, and that Jim had given me to try. And I thought, hang on, you know, you got this quite amazing gin that I was blown away by. It was made with stuff from the sea, and you've got people who are looking to need to raise some money to help the ocean conservation out. You know, maybe there's something we can put together there. And that was the genesis, the idea. And I thought at the end it was too good an idea not to do anything with. And that was where it started. And of course, with my background and the sailing, it all seemed a really, really good fit. And again, too good to just let it sit by the wayside.
Yeah, absolutely. So did you use Jill's recipe, or did you come up with your own recipe?
No. So we went into collaboration then, because it was still it certainly wasn't perfect. You know, what she'd done, it was very good, but it, you know, needed some refining, I think. So we went into, and because it was a bit of a side project, there was no great urgency with it. So it took about 2 years, really.
Wow.
And forth, and you know, I went over to her workshop in Waiheke there, and she came over to the distillery, and we tried all sorts of stuff, lots of different seaweeds, you know, bull kelp from the South Island, sea lettuce, you name it, we tried it, lots of different quantities, and messed around with different botanicals, and actually, in fair, you know, full credit to Jill, what we ended up with was quite close to original. After 2 years, we almost went full circle on it. It's probably a little more refined than the original one, but you know, it's pretty close to it. The concepts, if you like, are there. And that's why we went for it.
What are some of the botanicals that you use in Sea Lovers Gin?
Well, the three heroes, I guess, are the showstoppers, if you like, are the oyster shells, which technically isn't a botanical because it's not plant, but you know, we'll figure that. The oyster shells, and then we use kelp and rosemary. And rosemary is actually originally a coastal herb. Rosmare is the Latin dew of the sea, apparently. So in the Mediterranean regions where it originated, it was always found in coastal areas. It's quite a good fit, if you like. So those are the three heroes, and they give it its quite distinct character. There are the usual other botanicals in there, you know, juniper, coriander, angelica. There's lime peel in it as well, which adds a touch of brightness. It's surprisingly refreshing and bright. I think a lot of people expect it to be a bit, you know, mud flats at low tide, but it's not like that at all. And then the other one that's a little bit special, I talk about it from time to time, is we use two different types of juniper. It's still a juniper forward gin. There's still plenty there. So, you know, some contemporary gins certainly wander away from the juniper. Mm-hmm. I don't want that. But we use a Himalayan juniper. About 30% of the juniper bill is Himalayan juniper, which is a different species again.
Wow.
And it's quite different in its flavor profile. It's much woodier, jammier, a bit fruitier. And it adds a real depth of character to the overall gin. Yeah, so those are the key ones, really.
Okay. Now, one of the things also that I love about Sea Lovers Gin in the story is that it's not just inspired by the ocean, it actively supports ocean conservation.
Yes.
Why was it important that the brand gave something back rather than just simply borrowed the imagery of the sea?
Yeah, I just felt like it was a good thing to do. I got to be honest, that it was part of the original. It was baked in to the brand from the start. It was part of the original concept. I've noticed that there was a few other brands doing similar kind of stuff at the same time, and I really liked that as a business model. It gives you a focus and a purpose. And of course, with me having spent my life at sea and you know, enjoyed everything it's got to offer. Fishing and diving and sailing, it seemed like it was a really good thing. I felt very good about being able to do something, you know, give something back and try and help the ocean out a bit, because you know, it's certainly seen a lot in the press lately, particularly locally here in the Hauraki Gulf. Things, the ocean's under a lot of pressure, and I don't think people have really appreciated that. They've taken it for granted over the last few years. So I think it's super important to look after it as a resource, and I'm just, yeah, thrilled to be able to do something about it, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great cause. Now, Matt, looking back at your journey so far, you've been at it for 5 years now. What would you say has been your proudest moment or your greatest achievement so far as a distiller?
Yeah, I'd say that's a really good question, actually. I mean, I've been lucky enough to come away with a couple of awards. But you know, that always makes you feel good about yourself and what you're doing.
Yeah.
And, years ago, we won a double gold for the Barrel Rested, and just recently we won the World Gin Awards Gold and New Zealand's Best Contemporary Gin, the World Gin Awards. And that always sort of puffs you up a little bit, and
yeah.
feel pretty happy about yourself for that. On the other hand, competitions you can take with a pinch of salt. That's probably a story for another time.
Yeah.
But sure, I'll take it when they give it to me. But I think actually the proudest, and I'm lucky enough to experience this on a fairly regular basis, because I do a lot of tastings, a lot of events and things like that, is when you give somebody a product and it completely takes them by surprise and delights them. And you see the look on their face. And this can be anybody, you know, whether it be a top mixologist, or it can just be Joe Blow in off the street trying, you know, seeing you got free samples in the local booze store, you know.
Yeah.
And you when you see their reaction and the look of surprise on their face, and then the delight comes on, and then they go, oh wow, that's amazing. That makes me really proud. you know, that they weren't expecting it to be as good as it is, or the, or to taste like it was, and they're genuinely delighted by what they've tried. That's when I get the proudest moment.
That's nice. Right now, if you're looking at both brands today, Lunatic and Lovers and Sea Lovers, what excites you the most about the future? Now, you touched on your warehouse full of barrels. So is it aged rum? Is there another project or challenge you've been quietly dreaming about tackling next?
Yeah, well, I mean, the aged rum is the obvious one. There's years of work sitting in the workshop there, in the distillery. And some of it is, quite frankly, delicious. I'm super proud of the way that that's turned out. We're looking at some kind of launch for that in the not too distant future. Sea Lovers is going really well as well. So I really want to build that into something substantial. I guess from a business case, that's probably where the future of the distillery is headed more towards, because it's just a reality that gin is a more popular category. It's easier to sell and has become the mainstay of the business now. But of course, I've still got this great passion for rum, and all these years and all the long hours that I've put in over the last 5 years are starting to come and turn into something really quite special. At least I think it's special, and hopefully people will as well. So yes, look out for something, hopefully in the not too distant future. I mean, there's some adaptations to the brand and things going on, so what form it'll take when I launch it, we'll see, but hopefully in the next few months we'll be able to nail down some of those questions. One thing's for sure is the liquid is well bloody delicious, if I'll be honest. It's exactly the rum that I like to drink and that I wanted to make when I started, so there's some good stuff coming.
I'm definitely excited about that. Right, I just want to touch on something a little bit different. Matt, we're recording this interview on the 1st of July, which also happens to be the day that the annual excise tax increase comes into effect.
Oh, shoot me now.
Yeah, this morning I watched an Instagram reel that you posted where you visually showed us how much of a 700ml bottle of Sea Lovers gin is made up of excise tax as well as also GST. For our listeners out there, can you explain how many millilitres and also how much of the dollar value of a bottle effectively goes to the government in excise and GST?
Yeah, if you want to get depressed, I can do that for you. in that little video, I used the volume of gin as a representation of the excise tax. So it was a 700ml bottle. It was about 170ml is literally an excise tax. And then you can add another 90 on top of that in terms of GST. So cost-wise, per bottle of gin, so our gin is 42%, which is fairly average, you know, between 40 and 44 is reasonably common these days. So you're looking at the excise tax is just under $21 for every bottle, and the GST, you can add another $11.20 something on top of that. It's a substantial part of the cost of a bottle. I guess the big problem is that it's money that's going straight into government coffers. It's not ring fenced into harm prevention or any of that kind of stuff. There's a separate levy for that, which I haven't even talked about. Yeah. It's really, really strangling the industry. You know, we're talking about, everybody's worried about inflation, and yet here they are raising the cost of goods of something that millions of people enjoy on a regular basis. So everybody's cost of living goes up, and at the same time it's restricting the growth of a nascent industry that, you know, has real potential to become something similar to New Zealand wine. So don't get me started.
And I know that
spirits, you haven't got long enough for this.
Yeah, spirits is taxed a lot higher, and that if you're drinking, you know, by the time you do a rum and coke, and let's say that's sitting at 5% versus a 5% beer, your tax is far greater in your rum and coke than it is in your 5% beers. So
A lot of people don't realize the tax that effectively the same thing in both products. So it's ethyl alcohol is what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
Is what they're taxing. But they're taxed at different rates if it's beer, wine, or spirits, which doesn't make any sense because it's the same.
Exactly. Exactly. Right, Matt, finally, imagine it's Friday afternoon. The work is done. The emails can wait. And you've got a little time to yourself. Which of your own spirits are you reaching for? And what is the perfect way that you enjoy drinking it?
Ooh, good question. Well, I'm a seasonal drinker. Obviously in the summer, then it's pretty hard to go past a gin and tonic on a Friday afternoon. But my current favorite is I do love a dirty martini. So sea lover seems to work particularly well with the olive brine. It's a bit salty. Yeah, anyway. Quite like that savory profile. That's probably my go-to on a Friday afternoon. Only problem with martinis, of course, is they're almost neat alcohol. So one and a half seems about perfect. Two, dinner starts to get a bit delayed, and you know.
fair enough. Right. Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining me today on Tales from the Top Shelf. It's been wonderful hearing how a life spent sailing around the world eventually led to creating New Zealand's first botanical rum, and how that same spirit of curiosity and adventure later inspired a gin dedicated to the ocean that surrounds us. The story is a fantastic reminder that great spirits are often built on equal parts craftsmanship, imagination, and passion. So thank you for everything that you're doing and contributing to the New Zealand distilling scene.
Yeah, that's very kind of you to say. Thanks for having me. It's been lovely talking to you.
Great. Now, if you'd like to get your hands on a bottle of Lunatic and Lovers Rum or Scene Lovers Gin, jump onto nzspiritguide.com and find out more. And if you've already tried them, we'd love you to leave a rating and review on NZ Spirit Guide to help other people discover these delicious New Zealand spirits. Until next time, remember, support local, buy direct, drink responsibly, and keep your top shelf full of stories.
That's a wrap on this episode of Tales from the Top Shelf. We hope you've enjoyed this peek into the craft and creativity behind New Zealand's distilling scene. As always, sip slow, enjoy responsibly, and don't forget to support our incredible local spirit makers. I'm Susie from NZ Top Shelf. Catch you next time for more Behind the Bar stories.
This program was produced at Coast Access Radio with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Coast Access Radio.